Hello, I'm Eric Piotrowski. I'm a writer and a teacher. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. I am doing a commentary about Barton Fink. Right now I'm looking at the 20th Century Fox logo, so that's what you should be looking at when you start listening to this. It's just fading away now. I'm doing this commentary for a number of reasons. Number one, I love this movie. Number two, I wrote the Wikipedia article about it, which is now a featured article, and I did a lot of research about it. Number three, I show it to my creative writing students every time I teach that class, and we always have a lot of really interesting discussions because, above all, it is, of course, a movie about writing, and I've studied a lot about it, and I've talked to a lot of people about it a lot, and there's always a lot of things I want to say about it, and I just thought I'd put it all down here on this commentary for people to listen to. First of all, of course, hopefully you're realizing that there's the binging sound, the bell that's going off over and over again, that ding-dong sound, the bell is coming up over and over again in the movie, so watch for that. Also, you'll notice right about now, we're starting to see the camera moving in on the wallpaper, and it's going to start moving downward. The camera moving downward is a constant motif that shows up over and over and over again in this movie, and it has a lot to do with the fact that Barton is descending down into something, and he's, you know, moving downward. There is, of course, the underworld references with 666, and I'll show you that when it comes up. It goes without saying that I assume that people have already watched the movie without any kind of commentary beforehand. Let me also use this opportunity to say that I was really mad when I got the DVD because the menu, when you first started up, has... Charlie running through the hallway. What's up with that? Spoilers. 1941. That's not an accident, right? Okay, again, downward motion, right? And the fact that it's 1941 is significant. We'll come back to that later. Right now, we're seeing the play that Barton has written. It's called Bear Ruin Choirs, and that's an important piece of information, and I'm trying to find it in the Wikipedia article about why. It's an allusion to something, but I don't really know what. It goes without saying, hopefully, that, well, okay, let me just say this. Barton Fink is, in some ways, based loosely on a writer named Clifford Odets, who was a playwright in the 1930s that joined a group called the Group Theater, which is, as I wrote on Wikipedia, a gathering of dramatists which included Harold Clurman, Cheryl Crawford, and Lee Strasberg. Anyway, so there's a lot of background there. Again, the 40s is important because there's the whole Red Scare thing going on, and a lot of artists in Hollywood felt like, especially writers, felt like they were really under the gun, and the pressure of the studio was really getting to a lot of them. The fish, fresh fish line, I don't know if it has any special significance. I think it's funny. Of course, at the very beginning, we are hearing Barton read the lines, and we are seeing him as well. So there's this whole constant objective-subjective split that's going on. We are seeing Barton, but we don't see him speak, and yet we hear him speak, and that's really weird, of course. Barton is dressed a lot like that guy holding the suitcase at the end of the movie, so it's sort of like we've come full circle at the end, and here we're starting, of course, at the end of a play. So there's this constant cycle of back and forth and in and out as well. You'll notice that the lines we'll be hearing from that kid, and I don't mean a postcard, show up also in his script at the end of the play. You hear now the roaring of applause. Also, you see the producer there on the left. We'll see him again in that scene in just a minute. Have you seen the Herald, my dear boy? And they're now they're calling for author, and the rumbling of the crowd is, of course, getting louder and louder, and we're going to start to see it mimic the sound of the waves crashing against the rock when he goes out to Los Angeles. And we'll talk about that scene, hopefully, if we'll have a little time when it comes up. Meanwhile, he's obviously overwhelmed by this support and enthusiasm, and meanwhile, now we cut to this very refined scene. This actually was filmed inside an ocean liner, and I don't know if I'll be able to find the information about where it was filmed, but I know there was a luxury ship. Yeah, here we go, the RMS Queen Mary ocean liner. That's where they filmed the scene here for the restaurant. Yeah, Richard and Poppy, they're charmed, you know, lovely, wonderful. And Barton has to pretend like he doesn't want to hear any of this, and he's such a, you know, proud figure, and he's interested in the common man. And now notice when he asks him, have you seen the Herald? Barton says no. And he says, you know, oh, Caven could hardly contain himself. And we don't know anything about Caven except that he's a critic for the Herald, right? And now he happens to have it with him, and Barton pretends to, oh, no, please don't. Oh, nobody wants to hear this. But, of course, he starts reading it, and Barton really desperately wants to hear him read this out loud. He's probably read it before. We don't know, of course, but he's going on and on about... And this is an important theatrical thing because it sets the movie up for us. It lets us know exactly who Barton is. This is what we call info dumping, and in a way, it's generally frowned upon, but in this case, it's done so well because even this scene serves two purposes at once. It info dumps a lot of stuff for us to deal with, but it also presents Caven as a character in some ways, and it presents Barton as being somebody who's shy of criticism. I don't want to hear it, and he says, oh, we'll be wrapping fish in it in the morning, so I guess it's not a total loss. There you go. You know, and then he goes on about his gut and, you know, oh, the common man and all this stuff. And as we'll see very soon, it's mostly a front. I don't think it's fair to say that Barton doesn't have any concern for the common man. After all, the play that he wrote is all about the common man, and there's no doubt that he wrote that, and it may even be the case that he wrote it from a genuine concern and a desire to put himself, you know, in the common man up on a high horse. Why shouldn't we look at ourselves up there? But there's no question, too, that at least at the very beginning of his success, I say you're already enjoying some, there is already this tension in him between, whoa, I really like this fame thing. There's the bell sound again. It's a slightly different sound now, of course, but it's very different from the Hotel Earl sound we'll hear in a second. Here's his agent, Garland, and there's a very good deleted scene on the DVD that you should definitely check out about him talking about how many people come to the theater each night, something like 500 if the play sells out, and meanwhile 18 million or however many go to the pictures every week. Now obviously they're not all going to the same one, but it's a definite it's an indicator of just how different the scale is, and you know, if Barton believes this hype about his own hype about the common man, then in that case Garland's argument is very persuasive to him. I should also point out that in some ways, Barton Fink's expedition out to Hollywood and, of course, W.P. Mayhew's is based in some ways on William Faulkner, who went out to Hollywood and had a lot of falling out with some studios. I should also point out that the Coen brothers said that they never really, first of all, they never intended for any kind of comprehensive metaphor to come up throughout this whole film, and there's no one way to say, oh, this means this, and this means exactly that. They just often use a lot of things that feel right. And so, oftentimes, at the end of Coen brothers movies, I certainly feel like, okay, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, but I don't know how to deal with that. I don't know how to put it all together, you know? At the end of Fargo, the first time, I was just like, I don't get it, what the heck? So it's worth pointing out here, too, that Barton, it talks about obviously meeting the big shots. The only big shot he meets is Lipnick, and that doesn't turn out very well at all. So even this fantasy he has about what it's going to be like when he makes it big, he doesn't get anywhere near that. And part of that, of course, is his own doing, and part of it is what fate has in store for him. I love those glasses, by the way, that Barton's wearing, the circular ones. You know, there's a lot of talk about, when I show it to my students, sometimes they go, ooh, he wears such weird glasses. I actually think they're great, but it's really hard to find them. And there may be something to be said for the circular image, because when we see later on in Mr. Geithner, Tony Shalhoub guy, the director, I got the star for this turkey, his office, there's a porthole, and so there's a lot of imagery about ships, and we talk about slave ship, we talk about W.P. Mayhew, and there's a whole lot of things that we could get into later. Here comes the rumbling sound of the ocean, and there's the thing about Barton, that's a rationalization, Garland, and he said, Barton, it was a joke. That whole thing about it being a joke, you know, at the end, when he sees the woman on the beach, he says, are you in pictures? And she goes, don't be silly. So this whole notion about things being a joke comes up over and over again, you know. And Madman Mund, now I'm not mad at anybody. I'm not sure exactly how that fits in. But again, you know, there's all this stuff for us to deal with. And I think that's one of the great things the Coen brothers do, is they give us a whole lot of stuff. And oftentimes it's very hard for us to deal with all of it unless we watch the movies over and over again. And many times it doesn't even have to have some way of fitting together. But I think in the case of Barton Fink, it really does. We notice that the Hotel Earl is a very sparse interior. There's nobody around, obviously. The sound of the bell, very, very different, and it resonates and it echoes and it goes all over the place, and there's nobody around, and we always see the Hotel Earl with nobody in it, although we have evidence of other people being there, which is not accidental. He has to wait, of course. Chet's coming up from God knows where, and there's no external shots either. I mean, there are a few along the way in the movie, and he goes to see Lipnick, obviously, at his home. You know, there's the pool scene, but by and large, you know, they actually said the Coens didn't want to show an external establishing shot for the Hotel Earl because they wanted it to be claustrophobic. They wanted it to be very tense and very pressurized. Steve Buscemi, of course, obviously doing a great job as Chet. I love it, Chet. And whenever I show the movie to my students on the first day before they even start watching the movie, I take some of my business cards and I write Chet on the back and I hand them to them. My name is Chet. And they're like, what? And I go, Chet. And I hand them the card. And they're like, what is this? And then when they see the movie, they're like, oh, I see. But I still don't get it. Obviously, you know, when he asks, are you a transient or a resident? That's a very important moment, because it establishes that Barton does not know whether he's staying there or whether he's just visiting. And this comes back again later at the end when Charlie says, you're just a tourist with a typewriter. This whole notion that Barton wants to be near the common man, but he's not willing to commit to it, right? He doesn't know. He says, I'll be here indefinitely. So Chet says, okay, you're a resident then. And, you know, there's the whole thing about him writing his name in the book, which is kind of like signing your name to, you know, the book of life or whatever it is. We could assign all sorts of meaning, I'm sure. Talking about the shoeshine, yes, my name is Chet. Yeah, I feel like there's 100 million things I need to talk about. You know, again, evidence of people behind them. You see the keys hanging off the rack. That means that they're out, but they're, you know, they've left their key. That's because we're getting, again, evidence of people being at the hotel without us ever actually seeing them. And in some ways, that's sort of a stylistic thing, but in some ways, I think it is symbolic, although I can't exactly say what it symbolizes. Okay, we have Pete here. Pete, his name is not, again, I don't think it's accidental. St. Peter, of course, the archangel who welcomes you to the gates of heaven, who is sort of the gatekeeper here with the elevator, and he says, six, please. That's the first six. Long wait. Next stop, six. We don't see the elevator move, notice. This stop, six. And so again, we have the 666 thing that establishes the hotel as hell. The Coen brothers said that they chose a lot of greens and browns to suggest an aura of putrefaction in the movie. And so there's, yeah, definitely this whole sense of things growing and festering in the Hotel Earl. It also seems like the hallways are widening and narrowing as the course of the movie goes on. I don't know for sure. I do know that they established a number of different hallways when they were filming it so as to have practice runs and they could do establishing shots, especially when they were doing the dry runs of the fire scene when Charlie's running down the hallway. Look upon me! They had another hallway built already, ready to go. So while they were, and they had to redo it and set it all up again and put the new wallpaper up or something, you know, to reset it after they do the fire thing. They had another hallway off the off to the side where they were doing establishing shots, and they could do, you know, small scenes from the movie elsewhere. Notice, of course, that the two windows kind of look like eyes, so some people have suggested that there's this constant sense that Barton's being watched. The bed is eerily comforting and squishy, or at least enwrapping. You know, it wraps itself around the suitcase. You know, we could assign all sorts of meaning to that, I suppose. A lot of my students are surprised by the typewriter because, of course, many of them have never seen one, and it is definitely something of the time. It is a machine that is no longer used. I heard once that William Gibson wrote his first draft of Neuromancer on a typewriter. Whether that's true or not, it's certainly an interesting story. He can't open the window. This deep meaning here. He can't get out in any way, you know. And so he opens up the typewriter, and he's actually using an Underwood typewriter. You'll notice it's an Underwood. That's because there was a quote, and I don't think I'll be able to find it. Let me see if I can do a search. Let's see. Jack Warner, a Hollywood producer in the 40s, said that writers are schmucks with Underwoods, and that's why they said they gave Barton an Underwood. Okay, Hotel Earl, A Day or a Lifetime, obviously there's a lot of meaning there, again, coming back to this transient resident thing, and now Barton's first experience with the picture. You'll notice that we are going over his shoulder, going from the subjective into the objective, or maybe it's vice versa, I can't remember, but we are now moving into the picture, just as Barton is moving into the picture, and he's transfixed by it, he's captivated by it. The bell sound comes back again, and you can read whatever meaning you want to in there, but he's even hearing now the sound of the ocean, and it's very faint now, but as time goes on, he's feeling more and more this sense of the beach sort of moving in on him, and the tides coming in, you know, he's falling back on the pillow, and he's going to start feeling the mosquito. There's no mosquitoes in Los Angeles. Mosquitoes breed in a swamp. This is a desert. What do you got for me? The whole notion of the mosquito, I've read a lot into it that I don't know was intentional. For instance, when I went to do the research for the Wikipedia article, I noticed that nobody talked about the Capitol Pictures thing. And in fact, when I got the script of Barton Fink, I noticed that they spelled Capitol with an O, indicating that it has nothing to do with Capitol with an A, as I assumed, which would connect it to Marx, which, surprisingly, I found a quote from Marx where he talks about how capital is dead labor, and like vampires, the more labor it sucks, the better it does. And that connected perfectly to the mosquito. But that may have been unintentional. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. It's possible. I'm an English teacher. That's what I do. Lipnick is so happy to see Barton for the first time. He's just overwhelming. He's gushing with enthusiasm. He wants to hug him. Come on in. You'll notice he's got the statues in the back of Atlas, the guy who has to hold the weight of the world up, right? And so there's the whole symbolism of him as being all powerful. Over and over again, there's this whole thing about kikes this and kike that. I'm bigger and louder and meaner than any other kike in this town. And I don't mean my dick is bigger than yours. I mean, you're the writer. You know more than me. Coffee? It reflects this kind of anti-Semitism, even though Lipnick himself, he says he is the biggest and loudest and meanest kike around. So there's this constant sense of, you know, Jews having to self-deprecate, but also, as we see with the detectives, Deutsch and Mastronati later on, they say, yeah, I didn't think this dump was restricted. So that indicates that there's a very real anti-Semitism here, that the Jewish people are going to have to navigate, right? And Fink himself has to deal with. and he doesn't go to the pictures much. He establishes himself as very much of a New York person. He's coming from Broadway, and there's this constant split between Broadway and Hollywood. And Broadway is considered sort of high art, and the author has control, right? The author is considered a bastion of vision in Broadway. We're going to get to Hollywood, and Lipnick says the writer is king here at Capital Picture. But in reality, of course, we know, but by the end of it, Barton is, of course... It's hard to say that he's a slave, given all the horrible suffering and physical torment that slaves actually went through during the Southern United States' experiment with that hideous institution. But it is worth pointing out that he has no creative freedom. He is totally connected to the studio. He says Capital Pictures will own everything you write, and Capital Pictures will not create anything you write. So basically, he's in this state, and we see that W.P. Mayhew is also in that state all along the way. That it's just ridiculous. So and of course, Lou here is an example of what will happen if you cross Lipnick. You know, Lou has obviously done something wrong to make him mad, and you know, Lipnick was the bigger bully, so he forced Lipnick out, or he forced him. He didn't force him out. He forced him into this very subservient role where he has to do everything he says, and all he has to do is say, Lou! And he jumps, and he goes running to do whatever Lipnick says. So, again, there's this sense in which Lipnick could destroy you, but he doesn't completely destroy you. He fires Giesler later on in the movie, but it's not clear why he made that choice for him and not for Barton. The B picture, of course, coming back to this notion of A pictures and B pictures, the B pictures were the ones that were very quickly made and didn't nobody invest a lot of money in them. And of course, that sets us up for the idea of a B movie. But we don't ever hear the word movie in this movie. I don't think there's ever an instance of movie. All we hear is picture, 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 which comes back to Barton staring at that picture in his room. And that's an interesting moment, too, because Lou is trying to tell him about the story. Excellent story, Saturday Evening Post. And Lipnick says, the hell with the story. It's clear from the jump that Lipnick does not care about the story at all. He doesn't have any interest in what Barton's going to give him. He just wants him to fit the formula. We want to know his hopes, his dreams. And now he starts in with the orphan dame thing. It's a formula, Barton. You don't have to type your soul into it. The studio does not want a deep story. The studio does not want something challenging or confusing. The studio wants something that will put seats in the butts in the seats. And so when he asks him, is it going to be an orphan or a dame? And he says, both. There's this weird stillness. Maybe we should do a treatment. How could you possibly consider anything other than just choosing either an orphan or a dame? And later on, Audrey says, yeah, you know, sometimes W.P. Mayhew would give him an idiot man child to supervise, and that drove the producers crazy, she says. And that's because it doesn't fit into that orphan dame thing. You know, it's going to be one or the other. And it's, you know, if you look at most movies, there really is either an orphan or a dame. And a lot of times it's both. I mean, even movies that I love still fit this model. And it's clear that they're highlighting a very real formula that Hollywood tends to use. It's also worth pointing out that the Coen brothers have said that they didn't have any experiences like this. They're not drawing from their own experiences while they were writing the movie, because they felt like they've been treated pretty well by Hollywood, and they've had a lot of success, and they've had a lot of creative freedom, that not like the kind that Barton has. So in a way, they're writing about a historical moment in Hollywood, not their own experiences. The sound of the door opening and closing all the time. Whenever you hear a door open or close, it's always and whether if it's in or out, then it's going to make a different sound. And especially in the Hotel Earl, there's always this sound of sort of mist escaping or some sort of sealing of the chamber when they close the door. Barton starts off, he's very well dressed. You'll notice, of course, as the movie goes on, he sort of becomes a little more shabby, and he doesn't wear the tie as much. He sweats more and more. Fade in, a tenement building on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Early morning traffic is audible. This is sort of the same thing that he's... imagining the same thing as his play in some ways. You know, he's adding this thing about the cry of the fishmongers, and we heard at the beginning of the play, fish, fresh fish. So again, he's putting the exact same things down, and we can hear at the end of the play when the detectives are reading it, we hear the same thing we heard at the end of Barton's play. We'll hear from that kid, and I don't mean a postcard. So again, it's this whole circular thing. Maybe I only had one story in me, my play. Maybe when that was over, I was done being a writer, he says. So maybe he even realizes that he's stuck in this moment. Some people say that he's stuck in his own head. again, moving down. Notice camera moving downward, zooming in, but moving down at the same time. This whole thing about Charlie crying or making too much noise. We don't even know what he's doing. We don't know if he's laughing. We don't know if he's crying. We don't know if he's he could be, you know, amusing himself. There's all sorts of things he could be doing, and a lot of that's intentional. I think we don't know what anybody in the hotel is doing. We never get any clear glimpse of what they're doing in their rooms. If you pay close attention, especially after you know who Charlie is, for instance, after he talks about his appointment with a doctor, that led to an argument, and then he trails off. And then, after the end of that scene, when he goes back into his room, there's some really weird noises, and we don't have any idea what he's doing. So, Barton is, his fear and anxiety are compounded severely by the fact that he doesn't really know what's going on. And as a writer, that's a really hard thing to deal with, because you're supposed to know everything about what's going on around you, and especially if he has moved into the Hotel Earl in order to really get connected to the common man. Too many writers isolate themselves from the common man, where they live and where they work, and blah, blah, blah. So, he's trying to be at the Hotel Earl in order to get a sense of what it's like for the common man, but he doesn't understand it, and it scares him, because he's supposed to be telling the story of the common man. How can he do that if he doesn't understand what's going on? And of course, he's disturbed by it, and he wants the noise to stop so that he can represent his image of the common man rather than the reality of what the common man is dealing with. Let's assume that Charlie is crying in his room. Does Barton want to know? He says later he's worried that maybe Charlie is in some sort of distress, but we don't have any indication that he's at all concerned, other than he calls Chet and says he's making a lot of noise, right? So this whole thing about Barton being concerned, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. And it may just be the fact that Barton doesn't know how to deal with the fact that he's concerned. It may be the fact that he doesn't know what to do with his concern for Charlie. But it may also be the fact that he knows exactly what he wants to write, and reality is intruding on that. And he can't deal with the fact that Charlie is actually not being the common man that he wants him to be, that Barton wants him to be. And the picture's there again. There's the candle there, the fan. We saw a fan earlier in the elevator, and there's a fan there. Sometimes the rooms obviously do look cool, but in this case, the fan and in the elevator as well, there's a sense in which the fan is more of an indication that people are sweating and hot, and we have the whole thing with the wallpaper sweating off the walls. That indicates that it's not very cool so much as the fan is blowing this hot air around, and we could talk about Barton blowing a lot of hot air around or whatever if we wanted to get really symbolic. Great moment of trepidation here. He's scared. He doesn't really want to deal with Charlie. He doesn't like confrontation of any kind, right? I mean, if he really didn't like Garland's offer, Capitol Pictures' offer, he could have said no. He's somewhat easily persuaded, and he takes the path of least resistance in many ways, except when it comes to actually listening to people, I suppose. That would be a path of least resistance. He said he didn't call to complain exactly. Well, what does that mean? He didn't call to complain exactly. It's really not clear. I'll say this. I've never looked at John Goodman the same way again after watching this movie. I always thought he was cute little Roseanne character. I mean, he was a weird guy in Raising Arizona, I suppose, but this really took him to a new level, and I think, obviously, he did an amazing job performing, and all the actors do, I think, a really stupendous job here. There's so much nuance, and, you know, I'm curious to know what they thought about this script when they first read it. They had to have some trepidation, and I feel a lot better about the convenience of you, let me buy you a drink. That's a classic pickup line, of course, so it sets up this early tension, you know, affection between Charlie and Barton. Some people have pointed to some clear homosexual overtones. And in fact, the Coens said that they intended it to be, you know, the wrestling scene. They said, we wrote that as a sex scene. So that certainly had a lot to do with their intentions. And we can talk about the difference between the text as it stands by itself and the author's intention or whatever it is. But there's no doubt that there are some very intentional moments here of intimacy between Barton and Charlie. When, of course, the detectives ask him, you do have some sick sex thing. He said, sex! He's a man! We wrestled! It's certainly not in their imagination, I think. Did he talk about, I don't know if Charlie's talked about insurance yet. He hasn't. When he does, you need to pay close attention, of course, because he says fire, theft, and casualty are not things that only happen to other people. And if you've seen the movie, you know that there's a fire, of course, there's a theft, because Charlie says, I lied, it's not mine, when he talks about the box he left for Charlie. And casualty, of course. Audrey, why did I say Arlene? So in spite of what you might think from tonight, I'm quite good at it. And he says, no, it doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah, man, I've been talking nonstop for 20 minutes, haven't I? So he says, right, fire, thunder, casualty, or nothing's going to happen to other people, which, of course, is foreshadowing. It's a clue. Barton should have been picking up on that, but he isn't listening. He's sniffing the whiskey. He's nervous. He's trying to think about how he's going to sell himself, and he's going to try to get rid of Charlie in some ways when he gets tired of listening to Charlie, or Charlie gets tired of listening to Barton. And, of course, Barton is very happy that Charlie's having this reaction once he realizes that it's a positive reaction. Because Barton's very proud of himself, and that's why he says, you know, actually, I'm waiting for the pictures. And he does the same thing when the detectives show up, and they, of course, are not impressed. You know, you want my partner to kiss your ass? Would that be good enough for you? Some students have to have that line explained, is the egg showing or what? But, you know, this whole thing about playwrights, and it's an exciting time then. Again, the split between Broadway and Hollywood. Charlie knows a lot about the movies, you know. Walter Bury, oh, hell of an actor, could be a pip. He knows actors, but you can't be Jack Oakey. And, of course, when the detectives come back later and say, you know, did you notice anything about him? He said, hey, he said he liked Jack Oakey pictures. And he said, anything you remember might be important. I'll tell you, Fink, that was not important. Notice I didn't write it down. It might not be helpful. That was not helpful. You notice I wasn't writing it down. But in a way, we could say that the fact that Charlie likes Jack Oakey pictures is actually important. If we talk about the fact that, you know, Charlie wants somebody to do as much for me as he says later on about, you know, helping people out, we see consciousness as a curse. If that's true, then Charlie, you know, he wants people to help him escape. Jack Oakey pictures make him laugh. One stitch Oakey. And it's the whole thing about he wants people to give him a way out of his suffering. And Barton has the opportunity. And I think that's the really significant thing about this is that Charlie recognizes that Barton has the power to tell his story. And what an important thing. All of us want our stories to be told. We want to feel like our lives are important. And here's a chance. And in fact, here it seems as though Barton is going to be that avenue for him. Finally, he has a chance. I think this moment when Charlie's listening to Barton tell this story, he feels like it's pretty profound for him. Wow, here's a guy who's actually going to try to tell a story about a guy like me. That's amazing. Of course, Barton then goes on to talk about empty formalism and blah, 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 and he has to cover for it. You know, I guess this doesn't matter. And I could tell you stories. Of course, Barton cuts him off, and that's the very indication. Why me, Charlie? Because you don't listen! And listening is one of the most important things any writer ever has to do. You have to pay attention to the rhythms of life. You have to pay attention to the way people talk. You have to pay attention to the ebb and flow of conversations and events and story arcs and all that stuff. And it requires very careful listening. But it's very clear that Barton doesn't want to listen. Barton wants to talk, and he wants to hear himself speak. And I can't imagine being around someone like that who just wants to talk all the time. Oh, wait, I'm like that. Barton, of course, is referencing a lot of high art that Charlie probably never heard of, and maybe Barton's making it up, I don't know, but, you know, there's this idea that, yeah, they have a kinship because, you know, Charlie's interested in Barton's ideas, it's just too bad that Barton isn't actually interested in them. Cuts him off again there, you know, talking about his stories that he could tell, and now Charlie's getting frustrated, and we'll see him dealing with the ear soon, and there's this whole thing about an ear infection, and he's dripping, and then when W.P. Mayhew says, you are dripping, sir, you know, there's a connection there, and now he's talking about empty formalism, and blah, 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 and it's phony as a $3 bill. Barton's trying to give the appurtenances of being a common man, but of course it's clear that he has a lot of distance between himself and actual common men. Does he even drink the stuff that Charlie gives him to drink? You know, that's an indication. There's a lot of cultures where if a host gives you a drink or somebody offers you a drink and you don't drink it, that's kind of rude. Charlie's a little rude, too. You know, do you have a glass? But, you know, whatever. Barton has certain things to do here. Too much rivalry late at night. You forget there's other people in the world. That's a crazy line, of course, because, you know, there's other people in the world, but we don't see any of them ever. And, yeah, raising a glass to him, of course, Barton thinks he's being, you know, camaraderie. You can help Charlie just by being yourself. But he doesn't really want Charlie to be himself, and that's a tension for him. This is the first time we see the tension of the strings, of course, now. The bell sound again. The sound of the ocean coming back. He's looking at the picture. And this is the first time we had the wallpaper falling off, I think. Or maybe he goes to sleep before the wallpaper. No, there's the wallpaper. And you know, we can look at the wallpaper as being a representation not only of the heat, obviously. You know, you think, I made your life hell. But there's also this sense in which the wallpaper is gooey, and it's nasty, and it's sticky, and it probably smells bad. At one point, you know, Barton sniffs it. It's the grime, it's the ooze that's coming with the common man. It's the nastiness of real life. And Barton, in a real sense, doesn't want to get his hands dirty. He's scared of it. He's not willing to deal with that yuckiness. He just wants it to go away. And, you know, the reality behind the wallpaper, he wants it to go back behind the wallpaper so he can imagine his beach scene and escape into his idyllic sense of self-importance. And there's the mosquito for the first time. I guess we don't see it before that. I don't even know. Do we see it? No. He says earlier, yeah, there's a mosquito in my room. Place, all right, where do we put you? The hammering of the letters. Barton's typing on a typewriter. This woman's typing on a typewriter, the secretary. And, of course, he's very awkward. The circle there with the window. And we got the cowboys and Indians there. Or is that Lawrence of Arabia? I can't tell. There's palm trees. I don't know. But, yeah, Barton, of course, you know, waiting and nervous. I'm getting a phone call, but I'm going to ignore it. So yeah, this is live, people. I'm not doing any editing. This is all going on right now and right here. Yeah, okay, so anyway, Ben Giesler is showing up here, and he asks him if he's ever acted. And, you know, we always need writers come and go. We always need Indians. And, you know, it indicates again that the studio doesn't really care about him, and that nobody really wants to hear what he has to say, and they don't really care about him writing. Ted Oakum doesn't know, we don't know any idea who Ted Oakum is. I think he's somebody in between Lipnick and himself, and in between Lipnick and Lou, even, or in between Lou and Giesler. So, yeah, he has to sort it out, and so he calls up, and the secretary, we notice there's a different secretary the next time we see Giesler, so we can assume that he's sort of going through secretaries pretty quickly. He's kind of an abrasive guy, isn't he? How's Lipnick's ass smell this morning? Not the most friendly guy. He's very blunt and forthright, but he's honest. Giesler's probably one of the most honest people in the movie, aside from Audrey, because he tells, I got this right here, Fink, all screwy. And it's clear that Giesler doesn't even know what's going on. He's not in the loop, and there's all sorts of tensions going on between different members in the studio, but Giesler thinks that Fink's not going to be a problem, you know, don't cross me, Fink, he really is. Now, okay, here we go, in this cafe, it's the New York cafe, you see it in there, and it's a fake mural, supposed to represent New York, so in Hollywood, we have this representation of New York, and it's pretending to be like Broadway, or New York, in some sense, at least, and it's all about the facade. It's all about the fake version of New York. And meanwhile, there's this nasty reality going on behind the scenes, but it's actually in front of the scene. Ha ha, isn't that cute? The cute thing, of course, is when Ben Giesler is drinking both milk and whiskey or something in the other glass at the same time, and he can't understand why Barton doesn't get this idea of Wallace Beery wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap? It's a drill. It's simple. And when Barton says to Charlie later on, you know, Charlie, I admire you, your daily routine, you know the drill. It's clear Barton doesn't know the drill. So again, he wishes he had that understanding of what the drill is like, what the routine is like. And of course, when he says, hey, do me a favor, Fink, throw it hard, that again indicates I hate writers. That can't stand them. Lipnick said earlier, if all the writers were like you, I wouldn't have to get so goddamn involved. W.P. Mayhew is puking his guts up here in the toilet. It shocks Barton because it's such a nice, pristine place, and it seems like there shouldn't be anything nasty going on here, even though, of course, it's a bathroom. So Barton is really repulsed by this. It's a repulsive scene. It's also a really funny scene. My students always die laughing during this scene, and I'm the person laughing the hardest in the room because I just think it's hilarious. But, of course, many of them are repulsed, and God help us if we watch this right after lunch because then they're really grossed out. But, yeah, his first introduction to this person that we know he idolizes is watching him puke his guts up in the middle of the bathroom. What an awkward way to meet somebody. But it is, of course, a foreshadowing of what Barton is going to become, because we see W.P. Mayhew drinking already, a little social lubricant, and he says, it's a little early for me. By the time he meets Lipnick by the pool, Lipnick says, what do you want to drink? And he says, rye whiskey. You writers work hard, play hard, and we know it's an early morning scene there. So, again, this is where Barton is going. You know, he's going to end up like W.P. Mayhew, maybe. There's a good chance he is. And the bow tie and the necktie, who knows, maybe there's some symbolism there. Maybe he's just trying to mimic Louis Farrakhan or Jose Ramos Horta. He's humming Gone Are the Days When My Heart Was Young and Gay, this old Black Joe spiritual song, which again indicates his presence and his condition as a slave to the studio. He's feeling enslaved to the studio. He feels like he has no choices about what he does and where he goes. And he, of course, appreciates the fact that Barton likes him. Thank you, son. How kind. Barton doesn't even know what to say to him, but of course Mayhew knows exactly what to say to Barton, and he says, you are dripping, sir, where we come back to this idea of you are dripping, kind of like Charlie's dripping at the end of the movie. He says, I'm dripping again. This notion of something dripping out of him connects, of course, to the ooze coming through the wallpaper, and this notion of stuff coming coming out of us. And Charlie says, don't worry, it's not contagious, when he talks about his ear infection. But in fact, it may be that it is contagious and that he's sort of infected Barton with his sickness. And this would be a good place to cue the Disturbed song. Barton doesn't want to impose. He has a lot of respect for Mayhew, and he thinks that Mayhew is very happy and very busy. He probably expects that Mayhew is living the life that Barton imagined he would live, talking about meeting the big shots, going to the parties, and all that stuff. The only party Barton goes to is the USO show, where he gets beaten up. So again, there's this whole conflict between fantasy and reality. W.P. Mayhew, of course, has written wrestling pictures, or maybe he hasn't. We don't know, even. It's not clear how. I want to know how many of Bill's books you wrote, Barton says to Audrey later on. And it may be that Audrey's written all of his movies, but she all of course says, well, he was always the author, so to speak. What do you mean, so to speak? Yeah, come to my bungalow later on. And we see, okay, so here there's the sense in which it's sort of like a gangplank, and he's it's sort of a ship-like atmosphere that the Coens have created here. And when we see the door, we will notice that it says, Writer Mayhew Pictures Slave Ship. There was actually a movie called Slave Ship, and I think... it's a reference to a 1937 movie written by Mayhew's inspiration William Faulkner and starring Wallace Beery, for whom Barton is composing a script in the movie. So the whole Wallace Beery thing comes back with the movie that Mayhew is supposedly working on. And it's okay for me to read out from the Wikipedia article, because as I say, I wrote it, so. Get off my back! Our first time seeing Audrey, there's a moment at which she looks off to the right side of the screen, in the same direction that the woman in the picture is always looking. And there's some similarity between them. When I asked in my little Flash presentation, and if you haven't seen it, I made a little Flash thing with questions about the movie. I suggest that there may be a connection between the two of them. I don't really know what I think the connection between the two of them is, Audrey and the woman in the picture, but... the similarity between them, I think, is hard to miss, and I think it has something to do with the fact that she's an ideal vision for him. We know that Barton's a very lonely guy, and, you know, Audrey really is the only woman in his life. We hear him talking about his mother, but we never see her, of course. When she touches him here, he's electrified, and he talks about he wants to get together at some point, and he just doesn't know anybody, but, of course, that's probably a cover. He really is interested in her, but he doesn't feel like he has any way of talking to him, to her, and there's probably a great dissatisfaction Barton has throughout his life about being unable to connect to people. He doesn't listen, we know that for sure, and so he probably has a lot of difficulty talking to people and probably feels very insecure around women, despite the fact that he's, you know, supposedly representing the common man and very well loved and all this stuff. And, you know, at one point even he says... Okay, so when W.P. Mayhew's talking about Where's My Honey, he's probably talking about his wife Estelle. There's a very quick moment in the scene later on where he says, Audrey says, he sometimes thinks about his wife Estelle. She still lives in Fitzboro. She's disturbed. So he may be, you know, torn up with dismay about the fact that, you know, his wife is mentally ill. Who knows what's going wrong with her? And again, Barton doesn't know. He can't tell what's going on. And it destroys him, because for a writer, that's one of the hardest things to deal with, is not knowing something. You have to know everything about it if you're writing about it, and so Barton is stuck in this place where he can't know. Now, we saw one of the parts of this wallpaper slipping back earlier. Now, both of them are falling back. By the end of the movie, there's pieces of the wallpaper just hanging off, and it's clear that Barton doesn't care anymore. He's not interested in covering up the ooze of reality with the wallpaper of loveliness or something. This is a really disturbing moment. The last time I watched it, and this is 2011, I'm recording this. The last time I watched this, I noticed for the first time that there's a really bizarre sound mix here. The woman sounds like she's in pain, and the guy kind of sounds like he's snickering, which suggests to me that maybe somebody's being tortured or something here. I can't tell. Maybe I'm reading too far into it. Later on, of course, Charlie says, oh, do you hear those lovebirds next door? And it may just be the case that they get it on in kind of a weird way, but the fact that there's this... at least a somewhat perceptible differential in the power dynamic between male and female there suggests that there's something certainly unpleasant going on there. And you know, the Coen brothers said when they first, I should point out that the Coen brothers got the idea for Barton Fink when they first, they were stuck working on Miller's Crossing. They weren't really blocked, they said, but they were just, they wanted some distance from it. So they were, they had actually seen, while they were filming Blood Simple in Austin, Texas, they had seen a hotel, and they... just thought it was the creepiest place in the world. They said, we thought motel hell, you know, being condemned to live in the weirdest hotel in the world. And then later on, they wanted to come up with a place. The hotel was the inspiration there. And they said they wanted to come up with a place where, you know, it was people with bad sex lives. Let me see if I can find the quote. I don't know. I can't find that quote. Anyway, yeah, he said he's having trouble getting started. And, of course, what happened to your ear? And he said, chronic thing, ear infection, goes away and comes back a little bit. And, of course, that's what's happening with Charlie. He goes away, he comes back. I got to put cotton in and staunch the flow of his pus. It switches ears. In this scene, it's on the right ear. And in the final scene, it's in the left ear. That may be an accident. It may be intentional. It's moving around like Charlie's moving around. Things get all balled up at the head office. I don't know if I mentioned before, but, of course, Barton's windows look out on another building. And there is actually some warmth and light coming from them. For a long time, I always thought it was a brick wall, but I watched it again and I realized there's some actual light and people living over there, apparently. But again, we don't really see them. We just get a sense of them. Weirdness and awkwardness dealing with females. We know that Charlie is cutting people's heads off and housewives out in Kansas City. So Charlie certainly has some weird relationships with women. And Barton, as we see here, doesn't have any time for them. He doesn't have the ability to relate to them. And then there's this whole thing about attention. And you know, that's what Charlie wants. He wants attention, too. And he's sort of getting it from Barton now that Barton's stuck. Now that Barton's been taken down a peg. Now that Barton's realizing that he doesn't know exactly how to write this thing. He's having to stop a little bit. He's having to be more quiet. And that's good for Charlie, because now Charlie can sort of talk a little bit, finally. But we still see Barton interrupting him. We still have this whole thing about, you know the drill, and he cuts him off, and my job, the life of the mind, and that's a very important phrase, of course. Lies. He's not surrounded by family and friends, or at least we don't see it. He's not surrounded by anybody. He's totally lonely. And there's this moment where they can connect. They're about to connect. They're almost in a perfect moment together. You know, they both don't know what loneliness feels like, and Charlie's trying to tell him a story, and Barton just won't let it happen, right? That's a great line, of course, the story is to curl your hair. A lot of my students always think that's a goofy line to listen to. And that picture is important, too, because we see two pictures of Charlie throughout the course of the movie. One of them, of course, is that one, and the other one is his mugshot that the cops show him. And the fact that Barton puts... He's about to interrupt him here, isn't he? You know, in a way, I envy you, Charlie. Barton puts that picture up in the frame with the picture of the young lady on the beach. And it has a lot to do with, you know, he wants to think of Charlie in a certain way. He wants to think of Charlie as being the insurance salesman, happy, holding up his, you know, wearing his suit with a suitcase and all that. He doesn't want to think of Charlie as being Charlie Munt. There's Charlie holding up his ear, right? He's talking about the life of the mind, Barton is, and Charlie is now dealing with his ear. He's got pain, he's looking down, he's yawning, he's suffering, and Barton says, oh, it's a kind of pain most people don't know anything about. It's obvious that Charlie knows 10 times more about that kind of suffering and pain, being trapped inside your own mind, than Barton does. But Barton isn't willing to listen, and of course now he drops the Beery thing. He probably does that on purpose. There's a good chance that he's trying to get, you know, bounce ideas off of Charlie or something, or maybe hope that Charlie will say something that will inspire him. But yeah. I don't know where I was going with that, so I'll just stop. But, you know, the circular imagery, you can see on Barton's bed, of course. Later on, we see Charlie bending it back in order to free him. But there is the circular thing. The fan has stopped now. But that circular thing sort of arcs and things. I always read too much into things. And now, by this point, I've seen this movie like 40 times. This is certainly a suggestive moment when Charlie is sort of down on the ground. And, you know, this is how wrestling matches start. You know, real wrestling matches, at least. There's this sort of unusual pose that they start out in. I guess it's Greco-Roman wrestling or something. But, you know, there's this moment of hesitation. And Charlie's like, come on, you can do it, you can do it. And it's a weird face. This is actually where we stop the movie the first day of showing it, because we watch it and we have 50-minute classes, so we watch it in sort of 45-minute chunks. And so that's a great stopping point right there, and the students are always freaked out, like, what is he doing? And he's trying to get him to wrestle. And I love when they say on the first day, Mr. P, this movie is weirding me out. And I always go, oh, just wait, you have no idea. It's great. That line, there you go. We're going to wake up the downstairs neighbors. It is a sex scene in every sense of the term, you know? I mean, except for actual sex. He's a man! We wrestled! But, you know, Charlie hurts him. And, Barton's trying to play it off, but it's a moment where Charlie sort of exerts his supremacy. Charlie has the upper hand in some way, and he says on his way out, of course, don't worry, I wouldn't be much of a match for you in mental gymnastics, but there's a sense in which, and maybe this was Charlie's intention, he wanted to show Barton, look, you don't own me, you don't control this scenario, I do. And there's a sense in which Barton is freaked out by it, and is, ah, geez. What the heck's going on here? You know, he's used to being the master because that's what the writer is. The writer is the master of the universe. He controls everything. The master, the writer gets to decide what happens when and this and that. And there's a sense in which I think a good writer has to step back from the creation and let it happen by itself. A lot of writers say that once you get to know your characters, you have to let them be their own creatures. And we have the sound of the ocean again there, and now we're moving into the outside scene. And this is an exterior shot, one of the few exterior scenes that takes place in the movie. But of course, it's one of the saddest scenes. It's one of the most tragic scenes. Pappas and Swain there is a reference to two philosophers that have written a lot about the existential stuff that Barton's dealing with here. And Nebuchadnezzar is a very important reference as well, because soon enough, we're going to have Barton looking up the Bible passage having to do, it is in Daniel 2, that has to do with the king's dream. And the king, of course, is Nebuchadnezzar. So that's not an accident there. When Audrey says... Oh, she says, first of all, he says, I can almost smell the live oak. And she says, that chicken fat, Bill. It may be, again, that there's that fantasy, I want to believe it's this. And she says, no, it's this. She's bringing him back to reality. He wants to escape. He's building a levee. He wants to get away from it. When I can't escape, I want to rip my head off and run down the street screaming with my junk in a fruit picker's pail and all that stuff. You can tell this isn't a professional commentary because I'm not editing out any of this stumbling around my words. Okay, now we have the very important split about Barton and Charlie where they're talking about why they write. And I think this is one of the really important things for people to deal with when they talk about writing and how this movie informs the question about what writing is. Because I think for a lot of people, writing is just sort of escape. They like to make stuff up. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. And in fact, that's what Charlie is looking for in some ways. He wants people to give him an escape. There is something to be said for movies and art and things that just provide us an escape. Give us something happy to look at or something nice to deal with. An escape from our daily suffering and struggle and sorrows and misery and the fact that your wife is in an insane asylum or whatever it is, right? So, you know, when he's drinking, that'll help. He's building a levee, and he makes it very clear that he has to separate himself. And that when he says that I'm building a levee, you know, this notion that maybe he's scared that if he gets too close to Audrey, that he'll get hurt again, the way he's been hurt with Estelle. Now, when she compliments this book, you should read it. I think it's Bill's finest, or one of his finest. That's an important moment, too, because, as we learn later, it's possible that she wrote that book. So it may be that Audrey is sort of like Barton in the fact that she likes to hear praise about her own work. But there, she gets to be the one giving the praise, and Barton doesn't realize that she probably wrote it. So there's this really weird reverse moment from the beginning where Barton wanted to hear what the critic had to say in the Herald, and she's praising Mayhew's book, and he can't say, what are you doing? You know you wrote that, because that would be giving up his part of the charade. So everybody's got these parts to play, and there's all this fakery and trickery and facade going on, and meanwhile there's this simmering, unpleasant, miserable truth that nobody's willing to deal with. And of course, obviously, you know, the question about Mayhew looking, you know, Audrey looking at Mayhew with pity, you know, okay, it may be that it's not fair for her to look at him with pity. We don't know whether she looks at her with pity or not. She says she understands Mayhew, and what she really gives him is understanding, and I think that's true. She is there for him. She's willing to listen to him. She's willing to, and again, listening is the thing that Charlie wants from Barton that he does not get from him. So that's very important, and she says she helps Bill most by listening to him and understanding him and appreciating him. But of course, that's not, I don't know, I don't think a good relationship can be based only on listening and understanding and just accepting whatever the person says. I think a good relationship has to be built on give and take and a little bit of resistance. And the person saying, no, you're wrong about that. You know, and having that engaged discussion where you're actually having a dialectic and you're hopefully helping the other person to grow and evolve rather than just say, oh, you know, whatever, I feel bad for you. Nah, obviously none of that excuses the fact that he hits her, but it's Mayhew lashing out. And again, as I say, it may be the fact that Mayhew worries that, you know, he doesn't want to let Audrey get too close to him, he doesn't want to let anyone get too close to him. And of course, Barton has to step back. He's so mad, or maybe he's just pretending to be mad. Maybe this is, again, a chance for Barton to pretend like he's a hero of the common man or common woman in this case, and he has to stand up and just, you know, protect her. That son of a bitch! Who knows how he actually feels about him, but he certainly has to step back, and he's a fine writer, as if there's some way in which you can't be both or something. And he even defends Mayhew later on when Giesler's trying to say, he's a souse! He's a great writer. He's a great souse! And here's the moment where Audrey says, you know, he thinks about his wife Estelle. She's disturbed. She still lives in Fitzboro. And it's a very quick and, you know, I probably missed it the first time I watched it. It's a very momentary glimpse into Bill's backstory. It's one of the beautiful things about this movie and a lot of the Coen Brothers movies is that they'll put in a line that feels like a throwaway line. Right here. Silent upon a hill in Darien, I think. Maybe he yelled it before, but that's a really important reference to... Let me find out what it's a reference to. Silent upon a hill in Darien. It's the last line from John Keats's 1816 sonnet on first looking into Chapman's Homer. It's in the background. Most people never hear that line, but it's heavy with meaning. And he talks about the Pacific Ocean, and that's when Mayhew says, I'll just walk on down to the Pacific, and from there I'll improvise. And again, he's singing the Old Black Joe thing, indicating that he is destroyed by this system. And Barton knows that's where he's headed, or he should know. Circular shot, moving downward, downward, downward again, always moving downward from the mosquito's point of view here. And we could talk again about the objective-subjective thing. We could talk about the seeing the world from different points of view. We see it from the mosquito's point of view here. We should point out that Barton's got his glasses on while he's asleep, and very few people sleep with their glasses on, as they say in 12 Angry Men. He's looking around, up, down, and over. One of the critics that I read while I was working on the Wikipedia article talked about the stain on his ceiling being a reference to The Enduring Chill, a short story by Flannery O'Connor. I've never read that story, so I don't know. And it seems like kind of a stretch to say the stain on the ceiling is like the stain on the wall in this story. But on the other hand, you know, again, the Swain and Pappas thing, the fact that there's that Silent Upon the Hill and Darien line, I wouldn't put it past the Coens. I really wouldn't. It's too early to hear traffic, and I don't know. I want to say again that that's meaningful, but I don't really know why I would say that's meaningful. The meaningful part of this scene, of course, is that Barton is now in Charlie's shoes. And what is he seeing? What is he experiencing? He's literally in Charlie's shoes. And that's a moment where he's, you know, we have to assume that, for the first time, Barton's smiling. That's really the first time we ever see Barton come anywhere close to a smile, isn't it? He's always frowning and scowling. So when Charlie says, I hope these are your shoes, because that would mean they gave you mine. So Barton just had Charlie's shoes on. And we can assume then that, in a symbolic consequence, he's sort of looking around inside Charlie's head. He's seeing the world from Charlie's point of view. That's an important moment because it's the first time that he's ever really had any ability to empathize with Charlie. And of course, as we just heard Audrey say, empathy requires understanding. And Barton doesn't understand Charlie, so he can't empathize with him. But for that moment, while he's in Charlie's shoes, he sees so much more than he realizes. And he really has a glimpse of what it's like. And maybe he likes it. And that's one of the things that I think is toughest to deal with, is the fact that Charlie is not a nice person, not only because he likes to ventilate people with a shotgun and then chop their heads off, but because, you know, he says Heil Hitler. And what I would say is that if we're going to talk about the life of the mind, if we're going to talk about what it's like for the common man, if we're going to really represent the common man, we have to be willing to look at horns and halos. We have to be willing to address the nasty, horrible, racist, white supremacist, ugly, hideous parts of humanity, as well as the beautiful, noble, helping out a guy side of humanity. So he talks about the housewives, and we hear later on that there's some housewives who have been killed. Now he talks about the doctor. I told you my ear is infected. You give me $10. That led to an argument. And so we find out later that the doctor's dead, ear, nose, and throat man, all of which is now missing. Well, some of the throat was still there. Doctor, heal thyself with no freaking head. Good luck. He's got the doctor in his room, presumably. You notice, of course, that he never lets Barton into his room. I actually had a student this time around point that out, and I was like, yeah, good call. You never noticed that. Barton's stuck. He doesn't know what to write. Some people have said that the Coens wrote Barton Fink while they were having writer's block. It's actually not true. They said that it wasn't really writer's block, but our working speed had slowed, and we were eager to get a certain distance from Miller's Crossing. So they went from Los Angeles to New York and began working on Barton Fink. They actually wrote the script with the title role written specifically for John Turturro, and they were working with him on Miller's Crossing, so they had it with him in mind. And I've read some interview recently with some writer that said that it's good to write with a certain actor in mind. I think maybe Matt Damon or Ben Affleck were talking about that on the Good Will Hunting commentary. Mixing it all together! Where there's a head, there's hope. Notice how many times they talk about heads. That has a lot to do with what's in the box at the end of the movie. Of course, when Barton says, where there's life, there's hope, the idea being that you have to have life without just a head. If there's a head, then you're not really a writer. But if there's life in that head, then you are a writer. We can discuss all sorts of symbolic meaning there. Things got all balled up at the head office, Barton says, or Charlie says, it's late, I'm tired. Yeah. And of course, Barton's sad, I'll miss you. He's smiling here because he's trying to fake being happy, and we know that he's trying to fake being happy. But yeah. There was also the thing where Charlie said, oh, I hear everything that goes on in this dump, pipes or something. The fan's back on, of course. And he's... What happens to his parents? We don't know. By the end of the movie, of course, he's yelling into the receiver, trying to get the operator to connect with them. There's no response. It's presumed, we can safely presume, of course, that Charlie has killed Barton's parents, but we don't know that for sure. And again, that's part of the terror of not knowing, is that we don't really know what happened to it. And I think that's one of the things that drives people crazy when they watch this movie the first time, is that they don't know everything what's going on. They don't understand it. And that makes sense. It's easy for us to get frustrated when we don't understand something. And I think the Coens revel in that because they like to screw with us and they like to give us things that we don't understand. And sometimes it's wonderful that we don't understand everything and everything is presented in an absurd comic light, like in Big Lebowski, and then sometimes it's just this nasty mess of misery, like in Fargo. And it's like, how do you deal with that? Well, you deal with it by painting pictures of ducks, and by being a decent cop, and by treating each other with respect, and that's the end of it, you know? Yeah. Anyway, don't worry, you'll see me again, of course. That's a very symbolically foreboding line. Yeah. Barton's stuck. And it isn't until he puts the box on his desk that he really breaks his writer's block. I had a parent one time who didn't want her daughter to watch this movie. And so I suggested, you know, I understand that you feel that way. You know, it's not the happiest movie in the world, but I encourage you to check it out because it's a really important movie. And in fact, it has a lot of symbolic meaning. Now, okay, again, here, you notice the sound. Who knows what Charlie is doing? Some people think that it's coming from upstairs because Barton is looking upstairs, but I think it makes a lot more sense to assume that it's coming from Charlie's room and that he's doing something with that doctor's body. I assume the doctor's dead. We don't know. But there's some really weird sounds coming out here. And the tense strings are happening. So anyway, I told this parent, I was like, you know, you watch the movie at least, you know, see if maybe you decide that your daughter can watch it after you watch it. And she said, it seemed like an interesting look at writer's block, but I don't really know how important it is. And I suppose that's true, that it is an interesting look at writer's block, different secretary now. And this typewriter being used for a very different meaning, and we heard the bell again there. Now Barton's even more weirded out, obviously. But he has no idea how weirded out he needs to be. When Giesler comes out there, he says, you're a dead man, you're a corpse. And obviously that's foreshadowing there as well. What's in Barton's future? We can see the outside here, but there's the mini blinds in the way, and we can sort of assume that they're sort of bar-like and that Barton's still in a prisoner cage. There's no mosquitoes in Los Angeles. Mosquitoes breed in a swamp. This is a desert. What do you got for me? So such a great line. I love it. Picture. Always with the picture thing. And Giesler sees it as a process. It's a drill. You just go through the steps, you know. All these movies that they're putting out now, isn't Soderbergh producing one now? They obviously make wrestling pictures all the time. I should also point out that the Coen brothers were reading a book about movies from the 40s, and they heard about wrestling pictures, and they thought, what the hell's a wrestling picture? But this was something that was fairly common at the time, and so they looked into it, and they found out that Faulkner had worked on a wrestling picture, and that was one of the things that helped them to, you know, get started on this project. Again, Barton Fink is defending Mayhew there, and Giesler is just, look, hey, he's a souse, give it up. You thought, what do you get that from? You know, he doesn't want the writers to think. He just wants them to produce the thing that you go through the process. It's a formula. You know the drill. And, you know, Lipnick's taking an interest. What does that mean? We have no idea what it means, and we don't know why he's taking an interest in Barton, but, you know, it's bad news for Barton, certainly. And he's taking an interest. And, of course, when he says, what do you think this is, Gone with the Shakespeare, Hamlet, Ruggles, or, you know, he's messing up all these titles, again, indicating that he doesn't have a whole lot of familiarity with high culture. He's just mentioning it in order to disdain it and to talk about what they are not in the middle of. They're making a B-picture, right? But Barton isn't comfortable making B-pictures. And this has a lot to do with what Faulkner experienced when he was in Hollywood, that he was denied a lot of creative control. The people expected him to create schlock, and he didn't want to create schlock. Faulkner wasn't that kind of writer. He was interested in producing great works that really explored the human condition, as he said in his Nobel acceptance speech, the human heart in conflict with itself. So he's going to send him down to look at the dailies of the Devil on the Canvas movie that they're filming, and it's presumably a very formulaic wrestling picture, and Barton is weirded out by it. He's weirded out by the violence. He's weird, and of course, the violence in the movie he's about to watch here, The Dailies, mirrors the violence he experiences at the USO show. So it's foreshadowing of the foreshadowing that's going to then foreshadow, of course, Charlie showing up again at the Hotel Earl. Broad strokes. I'm sure that address has some meaning, but I have no idea what it is. Don't cross me, Fink. That line, of course, by itself is a crazy line because his name is Fink. Of course, he's going to cross him. I should also point out that there was a news story that MTV News broke, and I didn't see it anywhere else, but apparently the Coens have thought about and are seriously considering doing a sequel called Old Fink. And in the sequel, Barton has become a professor at some university, and he ratted on a lot of people at the House on American Activities Committee hearings. And so it's now exploring him as he's sort of later on in life being an even bigger... he's going even further down the rabbit hole, or the suffering maze, or whatever you want to call it. He, of course, is weirded out. We have an important moment here where the suffering of the actors and the wrestlers on the screen are being reflected in his glasses. So we have this sort of mimesis going on here where he's the picture is he's reflecting the picture, but of course he's really weirded out by the picture, and of course the wrestling is mimicking the experience he had with Charlie, so that's probably disturbing him as well. The date on the clapboard at one point, it's like 2 days before Pearl Harbor. And so that's an important thing to notice if you want to freeze it on the date on the clapboard and the eyes are gouging out. The name of Soderbergh, I'll find the reference here. Victor Soderbergh. It's probably a reference to Victor Sjostrom, a Swedish director who worked in Hollywood under the name Victor Seastrom. That's according to one of the sources I consulted. Here the whole thing is Orphan Dame. You know, he's back to this formulaic thing, and he feels like he needs to persist with it, and he's having a lot of trouble with it. And really, you know, if he took 5 minutes, he could probably come up with exactly the kind of formulaic script that that Lipnick really wants to see or hear about. But Barton can't do that because he doesn't go to the pictures much. He doesn't know what, and this is part of the problem, he doesn't even know what kind of art the common man likes. So how can he produce something that is appreciated by the common man? Of course, he goes on for half a minute before he asks how she is. Again, emblematic of his desire to talk and not listen. "I need help, Audrey," he says. And Mayhew's really in a bad state here. It sounds like he's gotten even more violent, and he's really lashing out and going nuts here. But Barton doesn't seem too concerned about that, of course. He's more interested in having Audrey help him. And, of course, this comes back when she says, only the last few books, and Barton gets up on his high horse, what a phony, William, goddamn phony Mayhew, all that guff about escape, I'll say he escaped. Well, we don't have much time. He's mad about that, but really what he's most concerned about is saving his own skin. Which, of course, that concept connects to Charlie saying later on, "It makes it so hot sometimes I just want to jump out of my skin." And of course now we have Audrey telling Barton that Mayhew said that he was a buffoon, and Barton doesn't want to hear that because, you know, Mayhew's his hero. And so the last thing he wants to hear is that his hero thinks that he's an idiot, but that's exactly what he just heard. One of my students asked me one time, how does Audrey get to the Hotel Earl? you know, if the Hotel Earl is hell, then maybe we could say Barton got there because of the sin of pride. Maybe we could say Audrey got there by the sin of adultery. I mean, we could read into a lot of symbolism if we want. I think that may be stretching it a little bit. You know, the fact is that the Hotel Earl is where the common man lives, and the fact that that is a hell, I think, is enough. I don't know that we need to assign everything. Some people like to say, oh, it proves that Charlie is the devil and blah, blah, blah. I don't really think that's necessary. It's also worth pointing out that one of the critics said that Barton Fink was intended to be a depiction of the rise of fascism in Europe, and that's Charlie being the fascist. And meanwhile, Jewish intellectuals in the U.S., represented here by Barton, did nothing to stop the rise of fascism. That's not fair. I don't think that makes any sense. The Coens said that they just sort of stuck in the fascist elements, Heil Hitler and Deutsch and Mastrinati as the detective names, just because it seemed right. It fit with the mood of the time, and they were about to enter World War II, but it wasn't that there was some holistic metaphorical representation that was all supposed to fit together where every person is someone in the puzzle. I think that would make things too easy. And the Coens also pointed out, I think quite amusingly, I can't find it. I'll try to find it. You know, a lot of people come out of the movie and they're frustrated by it. And they say that, you know, yeah, here's what they said. There was no need to go too far. You know, it's correct to say that we wanted the spectator's share in the interior life of Barton Fink as well as his point of view. Because some people say maybe it's a dream and all that. But they say there was no need to go too far. For example, it would have been incongruous for Barton Fink to wake up at the end of the film and for us to suggest thereby that he actually inhabited a reality greater than what is depicted in the film. In any case, it is always artificial to talk about reality in regard to a fictional character. So yeah, I mean, that's fair. You know, it's like, whatever. They said, right, there's never anything approaching that kind of specific intellectual breakdown, they said, you know, where everything fits into a nice, neat package. It's always been a bunch of instinctive things that feel right for whatever reason. Barton Fink doesn't end up telling you what's going on to the extent that it's... Oh, no, no. They said, excuse me, in 1991, Ethan said, Barton Fink does end up telling you what's going on to the extent that it's important to know. What isn't crystal clear isn't intended to become crystal clear, and it's fine to leave it at that. So... yeah, and the sources for all this are available in the Wikipedia article, so you should check it out, and then you can find the sources and read them for yourself. Barton is repulsed by the idea that Audrey wrote all his scripts. But, of course, that's the central point here, and it has everything to do with the fact that Barton breaks his writer's block by putting the package on his desk. If it contains Audrey's head, as it's safe to assume that it does, then it is fair to say that Barton is drawing from the wellspring of creativity that lives inside Audrey's head. If she wrote all of Bill's books, or only the last few, you know, then Barton is also sucking off of her creative energy, kind of like the mosquito sucks off of her lifeblood, in the same way that the studio is sucking off of Barton's lifeblood and sucking off of Mayhew's lifeblood. But Audrey, in some ways, is sort of the wellspring of all of that. So the studio is sucking her lifeblood through Barton and Mayhew, and she is the one who, in some ways, is the most miserable in the whole story, because not only does she have her creative lifeblood sucked out of her through Mayhew and Fink, but she also... obviously gets killed, but in the meantime, she has to put up with Barton and Mayhew understanding them and appreciating them because of their fragile egos. So in a way, we can see Audrey as a very feminist character, as somebody who, you know, in some ways is sort of the silent suffering woman who is sort of going through a yellow wallpaper type of thing where she's just sort of enduring the that's her cross to bear. Charlie talked about his weight problem being his cross to bear. We can see Audrey as maybe being a character like that, who's just sort of suffering through this misery, you know, the sort of feminine mystique thing, the second sex that Simone de Beauvoir talked about. But it's also that she's one of the strongest people in the movie, because if it's true that what Charlie really wants is someone to understand him, to help him escape, to help him deal with the problems and just listen to him, then Audrey is also doing that for everybody in the whole story, you know? And she doesn't get any appreciation. She doesn't get anything. She gets smacked in the face by Mayhew. She gets murdered when she goes over to Barton's room. So she's really the most tragic character in the whole picture, I think, even though Barton, of course, is at the center of everything. A lot of my students get really freaked out, and they don't understand
understand, and I suppose it's fair to ask, why would Audrey be interested in Barton at all? But I think this is in the same way that the wrestling scene is sort of a moment of intimacy between Barton and Charlie, where they really sort of have a physical moment that transcends their mental or emotional connection. So too do we have here a physical moment where Barton and Audrey sort of transcend their mental or emotional reliances. And we know that Barton is going to leech off of Audrey's creative energy, and in some senses here we can say that he's leeching off her sexual energy too, because he's never had any sexual contact. I think it's safe to say that Barton's probably a virgin at this point. And so now, when we go plumbing the depths, haha, coming back to that line from Barton, we're now going into the sewer pipe, and this was a very hard shot for them to film. Let's see. I'm trying to think of where it is in the thing. The cinematographer had a hard time with filming this. Where'd they say? Yeah, he was something like, oh, right, yeah. That shot was a lot of fun, the Coen said, and we had a great time figuring out how to do it. It's a reference sort of to the famous Hitchcock moment in North by Northwest, where the train goes into the tunnel, and the producer, or the, excuse me, the Roger Deakins, who is their director, or, you know, the cameraman, cinematographer, Roger Deakins, he said, every time after that, Joel said in an interview one time, every time we asked Roger to do something difficult, he would raise an eyebrow and say, don't be having me track down any plug holes now, the plug hole of the sink, right? And of course, we heard things in that plug hole, in the sewers, the depths, I hear everything in the pipes or something going on in this dump. We hear people vomiting or who knows what's going on, you know, the sound of sex, the sound of laughter, crying, pain, whatever. It's all mixed together down there in the sewers. Barton doesn't have his glasses on here in this scene, and one of the critics I read had made a really big deal about that Barton is seeing the world with his own eyes now, and he's finally looking at things in an unmitigated, unmediated sense, because there's no glass in between him and the world. I don't know if I see a whole lot of meaning there, but it is certainly significant that we're looking at his eyes, you know, and there's a lot to do with him seeing this creature finally, and he's heard it a lot, but he's never seen it before. So the fact that he sees this bloodsucker here on Audrey's back is quite momentous. And, of course, students are always freaked out at this moment, naturally. And they're like, why didn't she wake up? And then there's this. And then they're like, oh, my God. And they're freaked out. And they're like, oh, what the, what? And the Coens do such a good job of breaking the tension right now with Barton. it's such a hilarious moment. And, of course, Charlie is so concerned. But Charlie, when Charlie is concerned, he doesn't call down to Chet and say, hey, this guy's making a lot of noise. He goes over, Barton, are you okay? And Barton, quite understandably, is freaking out. The question, of course, is who did it? It's quite obvious that Charlie did it. How did Charlie get into Barton's room? Who knows? Is it important? I don't know. Again, sort of have the facade here. Are you okay? No. And he's nodding, but saying no. And, of course, we know that he's not okay, but there's all sorts of ways in which he's trying to hide the fact that he's not okay, but he's covering for his own fear. The first thing Barton does when he closes the door is he goes and he looks at the picture. So again, we have the idea of escape. We have the idea of him wanting to get out of this nightmare. And before, it was something that was kind of, you know, he just didn't like being there, he didn't like having to write this thing, and who knows what, but it's an escape hatch, and he's scared, and he doesn't know what to do. The Coens said that our intention, quoting here from the source that I got it from, the Wikipedia article, you can find the source if you go there, our intention was that the room would have very little decoration, and that the walls would be bare, and the windows would offer no view of any particular interest. In fact, we wanted the only opening on the exterior world to be this picture. It seemed important to us to create a feeling of isolation. And if nothing else, I think we can agree that the movie certainly does create that. We have the ringing sound. Chet is going around collecting the shoes. Now, it's important to point out that the shoes have a connection to the Holocaust. And I'll see if I can find that. When the Coens were talking about the Hotel Earl, their first conceptions of it, they saw it as a ghost ship floating adrift where you notice signs of the presence of other passengers without ever laying eyes on any. And then Joel said at one point, you can imagine it peopled by failed commercial travelers with pathetic sex lives who cry alone in their rooms. And I thought there was another example of where the shoes mattered. I think one of the critics mentioned something about a connection to the Holocaust because, you know, when Jews were killed, a lot of times they left their shoes behind, the Nazis would plunder the leather or whatever it was. So the shoes may be an intentional or maybe an unintentional reference in some ways to decimation and genocide. Now notice, this is the closest we ever get to seeing inside Charlie's room, but we can't see very much. And of course, as one of my students pointed out, we never see inside Charlie's room. And that's meaningful. I'm sure the numbers are meaningful too, but I've never really been able to put anything together. So Barton's in 621, Charlie's in 623. What? 621, 6, 2 times 1 is 2, and then Charlie's in... You know, you could probably find some numerology thing to do with it. If you ask the RZA from Wu-Tang Clan, he could probably come up with some way to make the numbers meaningful, but I don't put much stock into it. And we know that Barton's telling the truth here. He didn't do it. Charlie, of course, did. Which begs the question, if Charlie knows what happened, how is he so repulsed? Is Charlie acting here? Is he trying to cover up for the fact that he did this to Audrey? Is it possible that Charlie didn't do it to Audrey? Or that he wasn't himself when he did it? Is it possible that Charlie really does live two lives as Charlie Meadows and Madman Munt? Is it possible that he has multiple personalities or something? All of those things are possible, of course. But I don't know that it really matters. It may be that when Charlie looks upon what he's done with somewhat fresh eyes, he's repulsed in a way that he isn't when he's actually doing it. Or maybe he does it and leaves, and then he has to look at it and face it in a way that he hadn't faced it before, and he's really revolted by that. Or maybe he's just acting, or maybe all of the above or none of the above. It's anyone's guess, I suppose. Now, of course, it's worth pointing out, Charlie doesn't want Barton to call the police for obvious reasons. Who knows what they would find in Charlie's room, right? Now, Barton never says he had sex with Audrey here when Charlie asks, but it's safe to assume, and Charlie says, oh, they can tell that sort of thing. They got to have mercy. Now, that in some ways connects to the Bible passage, because the Bible passage has everything to do with King Nebuchadnezzar wanting the, I guess, the Chaldeans or the wizards or somebody to tell him the dream. He has forgotten the thing. He says the thing is gone from me. He doesn't remember his dream at all, but so he wants to know what the dream was and what the interpretation is. And so when Barton says they got to have mercy, in a way, he's talking about himself, because Nebuchadnezzar says, if you do not show me the dream and the interpretation thereof, I shall have you cut into pieces and of your houses shall be made a dunghill. And so Barton is worried that he's going to face that fate, and he wants people to have mercy. He wants the king to have mercy. I suppose we could say Lipnick is the King Nebuchadnezzar here. But then we'd be stretching the metaphor a little. Charlie has no respect for what's in her head, man. I realize that sometimes I go a little crazy with the symbolism interpretations and the intenuandos. But it's certainly a funny moment when he bangs her head. It's so amazing how the Coens will drop in this totally inappropriate humor in a moment where there's this deadly serious stuff going on. And it's pretty crazy. Charlie says all this stuff about, you gotta go about your business, give me some time to sort this out, we gotta keep our heads, he says. I guess he says that later on, but Barton's late for his meeting with Lipnick, and this is the one last moment when Lipnick is still in his, I mean, talk about multiple personalities. The whole time that we've seen Lipnick so far, he's Barton's best friend in the world. He wants to make Lou kiss his feet, and then he does it. So he's the most giving and generous and kind boss you could ever hope to have. But then, of course, by the end of the movie, in some ways, he's worse than Charlie. So there's this whole notion of, you know, him having total power. They got to have mercy. And then at the end, he has no mercy. He doesn't even just destroy Barton's life. He also gets rid of Geisler, whatever his name is. And again, Lipnick wants his formula read back to him. We saw, by the way, Barton asked for the rye whiskey. Yeah, you write as work hard, play hard. Again, there's an indication that Barton has now become like all the other writers. And that's not always a good thing, of course. he starts to give Lipnick what he wants to hear, a tenement building on the Lower East Side. And, of course, Lipnick's very happy. He's poor, this writer. He wants to hear a rags-to-riches story or something. He wants to hear the formula spit back to him. But Barton can't give him that, because I don't know why. I suppose he's still stuck on this idea that, you know, he's the one who can represent the life of the mind. Or it may be that he's really come to see what the life of Charlie's mind is like, and he wouldn't feel comfortable repeating the formula. Or maybe he's in shell shock because he just woke up next to a dead woman. There's all these sorts of meanings, I suppose, we could approach to that. That's such a great line as well. Drinks it all in one gulp, mimicking the Mayhew moment where he knocks back that flask. And of course, it's a classic misdirection when Lou starts to chew him out, and we think Lipnick's furious at Barton, when of course he acts furious at Lou. And it's worth pointing out that later on in the movie, Lou is back in the studio, yes, Colonel, you know, right back where he was at the beginning of the movie. We might even be safe in assuming that this sort of thing goes on with Lipnick and Lou all the time, and then he lets him in, and he fires him, and then he brings him back, and he fires him just to exercise his power and to show mercy. This whole notion of they gotta have mercy. Lou's trying to read Lipnick's mind. He's trying to do what he thinks Lipnick wants to hear. And it's always a dangerous thing when you do that with somebody in power, of course, because maybe you're going to get it right. Hopefully you'll get it right. And maybe you won't. And we see this in Smithers and Burns on The Simpsons and lots of other places, too. The contents of your head are the property of Capitol Pictures. That's a pretty chilling line. And we see at the end of the movie exactly how real that is, because anything he writes is the property of Capitol Pictures, but Capitol Pictures is not going to produce anything that he writes. There is no more miserable place for a writer to be than stuck in a place where you are obliged to create things for a company, but they won't do anything with them. I mean, this is why Prince carved the word slave into his face. Creative people cannot stand to be in this situation. And artist after artist in the hip-hop world always keeps making these songs about how you've got to watch out for the snakes in the game, and Dead Prez just put out a song where they talk about the game is a battlefield, and we're just a bunch of soldiers, and we get fed to the cannons like fodder. And, you know, a lot of creative people find themselves in these situations where they are indentured servants, if not actual slaves, to the production companies, because the companies want to make money. That's all there is to it, and they don't give two craps about the artistic integrity, except when they can and it doesn't interfere with the bottom line a little bit for the critics. You know, there's a sense in which production companies and producers and the people who control the gates of creativity, they'll allow a little creativity to get out here and there, because you have to do that for the critics, like Lipnick says. But you can't run away with it. That can't be the basis of it. It has to be about money. And if the choice for the production studio is making money or exploring some really important creative terrain, most production companies are going to go with making money. And that's why we get 17 Rocky movies and 100 Transformer sequels and all the rest of it. But still, that face is such a beautiful, I love it. Lipnick is still presenting this facade of like, we love you, you're wonderful, we respect your methods, and all the rest of it. Every time we see a shot like this, we see the picture. When Charlie is down on his knees begging Barton to come on and wrestle with him, we see the picture in there. And it's on the cover of the DVD, it's everywhere. That picture is omnipresent. All right, that sound when he opens it. The air rushing in. Barton. Charlie comes in with the package. What's in the box? It's Audrey's head. I mean, what could it be? There's symbolic meanings we can assign to the box, and we can talk about how it's... Some of my students say it's Barton's imagination, or it's Barton's soul, or something, and I suppose there's a case to be made for that, but it doesn't seem... I mean, when he shakes it, it sounds like a head. It's the same shape as a head. It's... Her head's missing. Why wouldn't it be her head? Well, we know that's not true. He doesn't know that Mayhew's dead. And so, I mean, it may be true that, you know, he knows other people in Los Angeles, but he doesn't know anybody in a real sense. Notice the wallpaper there. It's just hanging off, and Barton doesn't seem to care anymore. Losing my mind.
I mean, obviously, Barton's in a horrible state here, and Barton is at his lowest point right now. He's crying for real. He's feeling real emotions. And, of course, this is a great line. Gotta keep our heads. It's one of the sources talked about how many times the word head appears in the script. It's a lot. So here Charlie says that the box contains a lot of personal things that I want to drag around with me. Okay, so if he's talking about Audrey's mind, it's Audrey's head, it's her mind, it's her creative energy that Barton feeds off of. It's obviously a lot of personal stuff. Audrey is carrying around personal things. She's got creative, she's a filter. She takes in the world. She absorbs the suffering of Barton and W.P. Mayhew. And then she turns it into creative stories. Make me your wrestler. Then you'll lick that story of yours. And Barton, in a way, does make Charlie the wrestler. But that's not what Lipnick wants to hear. Of course he will. And this is the moment when Barton sits down and cries for himself. He's still thinking about himself. He's still worried that he's going to get in trouble. And it's obviously a realistic fear for him to be worried about. But it doesn't seem as though he's grieving for Audrey. It doesn't seem as though he's sad about the death around him so much as he is miserable about his own experience. And in fact, when he has an opportunity to talk to Charlie about all the stuff going on, the question he asks is, why me? He wants to know why he has been chosen for this. But he never asks about why he's been chosen for literary greatness. He just wants to know why he's been chosen to suffer. And in a way, we come back to a religious question here. Barton is, Charlie talked about his cross to bear. And Barton is now experiencing this sort of Job-like moment where everything's falling around, all around him. And he doesn't know how to deal with it. He has trouble making sense of it. And again, that's a very hard thing for a writer to confront, the fact that they can't make sense of their own life. And this is something that drives a lot of writers crazy. Nelson Algren had a lot of trouble with this. F. Scott Fitzgerald had a lot of trouble with it. Now Barton sees the Bible, and he's going to open up to the passage from Daniel 2. It's worth pointing out that, at least according to my research, the way that they word the passage here on the screen is actually a meshing together of several different parts of the passage, and I didn't find an exact translation like this in the new the King James version of the Bible, but I didn't do so much very, very careful research. So it's the king's dream, and again, it's the thing about Nebuchadnezzar having a dream to the Chaldeans. I recall not my dream. Make it known unto me my dream and the interpretation. You should be cut into pieces. If you can't do it, you'll be cut in pieces. And later in the passage, it says if you will do it, you'll get all sorts of rewards and gold and treasure. And this is the position Barton's in. If he can give Lipnick what he wants, and if he can reveal to Charlie his dream, if he can help him make sense of his reality, then he could have riches and awesomeness. But because he can't, cut into pieces, and of your tents shall be made a dunghill. And then, of course, there's the whole thing he sees with Genesis mimicking his own story, and there he is sort of seeing himself as a godlike figure, but then again, he's also Job, and he's got a cross to bear, so maybe he's Jesus, and now he's going down, down, down into the depths, and the fan is going, but it's clear that it's not a very cool environment in there, and the conversation he has with Pete is hilarious because he talks about, have you read the Bible? And Pete says, Holy Bible? Well, I don't know. Are there other Bibles? I mean, maybe Pete's referencing the Satanic Bible or something, but yeah, I heard about it. Again, the notion that maybe we don't need to have a total familiarity with a particular text so much as we need to sort of know about it, kind of the way that Geisler knows about... No, it is Geisler, because he corrects, yeah. Many times I've seen it, you think I know that. But no, the same way that Geisler sort of references Gone with the Wind or Hamlet in a very obscure way, indicating that he's only heard about it, so too does Pete seem to have that same relationship with the Bible. So now we have the detectives, Deutsch and Mastrinetti, or whatever his name is. Mastrinetti. It's, They're common men, and Barton wants to make it clear that he's on their side, but they don't care. He's trying to build himself up. As a matter of fact, I write for the pictures. Tries to indicate that he's on their side, but they don't care. Ain't that a load off? And of course, the writing here is so beautiful because this is what the Coens do best, is they write characters that speak economically and they reveal so much through all their few words. And that moment with the picture, again, reveals so much about it. As soon as Barton sees the picture, he knows exactly what's been going on. It sheds so much light on everything, just that one moment with that photograph. And again, that's a photograph that contrasts with the photograph that Barton had put up in the picture frame of Charlie plying his trade, so to speak, as an insurance salesman. Funny, we come back to this idea of funny. Barton, it was a joke, don't be silly, at the end of the movie. And in that contrast with mad, you know, I'm not mad at anyone, Barton. Kansas City Housewives. Okay, so we heard him talking about that's me plying my trade in Kansas City. That was taken by one of my policyholders. And then the doctor, there we go again. So we know that Charlie killed the housewives. It's like everybody that Charlie talks about earlier in the movie, they end up dead. It's not accidental. It's not, you know, it's amazing. Again, the script is so carefully constructed to make it all tie together. But it feels when you watch it like just a bunch of random stuff. And he can answer honestly. He's never seen Charlie with anybody else. Certainly he never saw her with Audrey. He never saw him with Audrey. And it's, you know, this thing where, okay, so then there's a question, was Charlie jealous of Barton getting it on with Audrey? It's possible, I suppose, that they had some intimacy, and so he feels like he's threatened by Barton being together with Audrey. But I think it's not so much a carnal thing as it is a mental and an emotional intimacy. Again, the thing with Jack Oakey, I don't know if you could say it's helpful, but it's significant that Charlie likes Jack Oakey pictures because he likes to escape. There's a sense in which he wants to just sort of get some release from his life through Jack Oakey pictures, and he can't do that with the unwillingness to listen. There we go with the anti-Semitism and Fink trying to, you know, bristle against it, but it's clear that these detectives don't care what Fink thinks. Total jerk move by the detective, of course. And it's interesting later on when they're, okay, so in this moment now when we come back to this, I love to listen to this moment in class because the students are now realizing, oh my God, I know what's in the box! And they're freaked out by it, and of course he shakes it, and it's worth pointing out that when the detectives come back at the end of the movie to read Barton's script, the one of them says, I thought you said you were a writer, Fink, and the other one says, I don't know, I kind of liked it, indicating that perhaps Barton's movie might appeal to the common man in a way, or, you know, at least there's a diversity of opinion, and we could talk about the studio knows the audience wants to see action, adventure, wrestling, and plenty of it. They don't want to see a guy wrestling with his soul. Again, this presumes that audiences are monolithic and that everybody wants what the lowest common denominator wants, and that's what studios are gambling on. That's why they show movies to test audiences, and they change the movies based on how the audiences respond. And so in a way, the movies are these days are created by committee. And they say that a camel is a horse designed by committee. And a lot of times we end up with movies that are sort of camel-like. And even in the case of District 9, which I think is a great movie, it has a certain confusion of vision at a certain point. And it feels like it kind of becomes a buddy film two-thirds of the way through the picture. And I think that kind of detracts from the awesomeness of it. And that's probably a result of test audiences and them saying, okay, we need to take it this way, or, you know, how would you respond to that? Or some person in the studio saying, you know, getting notes. You watch The Simpsons and, you know, there's all this stuff about these Fakakta Network notes. This is a real thing, you know. People on South Park and on the Futurama, they talk about the commentary. They talk about all the notes they get from the studio and how they want them to change it this way. They want them to change it that way. Obviously, Barton's working at a time where the studio didn't have that sort of micromanaging thing, but in a way, maybe Barton wishes that they did, because all he can do is sort of give them his best shot, and then they come back and they say, not good enough. It's going in the garbage. Barton is really trying here. I think he's trying to create, at least he thinks he's creating something that is of real value. He says later on he wanted to show you something beautiful, something about all of us. How well he succeeds or not, it's really not clear. We know he sort of starts and ends it the way he starts and ends his play. Camera moving down again. But it's not at all clear. You know, there is a moment in there where the woman says, if you were a real man, you'd slap me. And it's possible that that's Barton expressing a sense, like Mayhew has, that you smack a woman around when she's getting in your business. And of course, Barton thinks he's doing something awesome here. He calls Garland to talk about how big it is. It's fair, I think, to say that, you know, if we accept that Audrey is unleashing some of her creative power through the box onto the script, then Barton probably is turning out something that, I mean, it may even be that Barton's turning out something that both fits the formula to an extent, because Audrey was all about it's just a formula, but also has some deep meaning to it and has some real significance. But it's also possible that he's turning out something that he will impress himself, but not really anybody else. Although, again, the detectives do sort of disagree about whether it's a good story or not. And then again, it's clear here that Barton isn't really interested in hearing what Garland has to say. It's unclear whether Garland wants to hear what Barton has to say. Certainly, Garland is not saying what Barton wants to hear. Garland's asking a question about Barton. You sound a little... Who knows what he's going to say. But Barton wanted to hear Garland say, oh, that sounds great. I want to know more about it. But that's not what Barton gets. Instead, he gets concerned questions. It's also worth pointing out, of course, that Barton has plugged his ears up with cotton or whatever. Another indication of the fact that he's not willing to listen and he wants to block everything out, despite the fact that he's now really surrounded by the ooze of reality in the Hotel Earl. And the thing about a postcard, of course, is the same thing at the end of the play. And the burly man is, well, I don't really know what the significance of the burly man is. It's the title of the play. Or it's the title of the script, at least. The USO show, a very physical manifestation of violence. There's a good chance, since the dailies we just saw, of the wrestling movie, are taken a couple days before Pearl Harbor. It's quite likely, as one of the research sources I saw said, that these soldiers are preparing to go off to fight in the European theater. Actually, that would probably not make sense, would it? They're in Los Angeles. They'd probably be going to the Pacific Theater. But, Barton, meanwhile, is celebrating the construction of something good. He sees himself as completely different from these soldiers. He sees himself as a creator, somebody who's making something positive, and meanwhile, all these monsters, as Barton says, are destroying things and making war. And this is a trap a lot of artists fall into as well. They see themselves as the bastion of goodness and light and creativity and, you know, the life of the mind. And meanwhile, all these common people are out, destroying things and living lives of quiet desperation. And nobody appreciates how deep the writer is plumbing the depths, as Barton says, and you know, working to understand reality and blah, blah, blah. And there's a sense in which Barton's not willing to listen to these guys either, you know. And he wants to own the woman that he's dancing with. He wants to control her and not let the guy in on the dance, despite the fact that he may be going to his death to fight in a war that is presumably going to help protect Barton and other people. But mostly this is a scene about Barton, I think, being egotistical and bragging about how important he is. And then he's face to face with this violence and he's shocked by it. Even though he's been around violence for, you know, quite a few days now, he's taken aback by the brutality with which these guys are laying on hands with each other. And meanwhile, of course, the band keeps playing. The band plays on, haha. And there's the camera pushing in on the plug hole of the trumpet in a way, sort of mimicking the going down the drain, certainly in the high-pitched note. echoing off. And, it, you know, it may be my imagination, but it feels like the hallway is narrower here now. It feels like the walls are closing in. I saw a production of Macbeth one time where the set actually did that. As the play went on, the walls literally closed in on Macbeth. And I thought that was a really cool way to approach it. And I wouldn't put it past the Coens to do something like that. There are certainly some shots where Charlie's running down the hall where it looks really narrow. But it could just be my imagination or my desire to read things into stuff. Again, the repetition of the line at the end there. The wallpaper just hanging off now in sheafs everywhere. And the guy, the detective there, is staring at the picture too. So there's a sense in which it does provide some sort of escape. There's the disagreement. One of them likes it. One of them says, "I thought you were a writer." So now we see Mayhew is dead, presumably at the hands of Charlie. No suspects yet. The fact that he had been missing might indicate that he was sort of AWOL without Audrey, or it might just be who knows what. There's again that sound of the ocean as they pan over. "No kidding, bright boy." That's a great line. References to smelling things. "My head is killing me," talking about heads again. Best line in the movie. Of course, I always had to censor it when I mentioned that line in the class, you know, and I say, "You're a sick man, Fink." "That's not what he said, Mr. P." Yeah, I know that's not what he said, guys. We're in a classroom. Come on, let's elevate our language a little. Obviously, a very tense moment. What is there to say? Is the wallpaper hanging off in the hallway now, too? You know, the sense that it's so hot now, my head is killing me, the pressure of being here is certainly a very significant. If you watch the little flash presentation I made, there's a great quote from Italo Calvino there where he talks about how we deal with the inferno that we're all living in. We can either, as most people do, become part of it and not even notice that there's an inferno all around us. Or we can try to find those things which are not inferno and help them survive, give them space. And that's a really important concept here because it's clear that, you know, some of my students say, "Charlie just goes back into his room. What the heck? He doesn't even seem to realize that the inferno is burning, that the hotel is on fire. Nobody in any other rooms says anything." Well, yeah, because they're all living in hell too. They're used to it. They've just accepted the fact that they're living in hell, and their lives are misery. But Barton isn't quite there yet. He's not a resident. He's still a transient. So he leaves. Charlie, meanwhile, says, "I'll be next door if you need me." Barton's had enough. He's leaving. Now, I would suggest that there may be some significance to the fact that the EL is not visible in that light there, and it just says evader. If we were to respell it, we could do EVADER, you know, evading things. But that might be a little too much reading into it. But I'm an English teacher. That's what I do. That's my life. That's a Neil Hamburger classic line, by the way. Okay, so when Charlie says, "I'll show you the life of the mind," my take on it is that, again, this is the ugly, nasty, hideousness that sometimes rears its nasty, ugly, hideous head in the human mind. We all have nasty thoughts. We all think things, and then we think, "Oh my God, how did I just think that? How did I just have that thought?" And some people are really unsettled by the fact that they think such nasty things. The point being that the life of the mind is not, as Barton originally presents it, some sort of noble, pristine thing that is always about how can we best ethically and morally navigate this situation. Sometimes the life of the mind is cruel and vicious and nasty and racist and horrible and violent and gruesome. And there is certainly a lot of truth to be said about how Charlie knows about the life of the mind because he has a mind. Cogito ergo sum. All of us have a life of a mind, and there is no way in which Barton is inherently privileged to go and plumb the depths and come up with something that is more meaningful just because that's his job. There is no way in which Barton has some sort of exclusive access to a life of a mind that is more significant than Charlie's access to the life of his own mind. And that's something that's very difficult for Barton to deal with as well, because Barton likes to think of himself, because he is a writer, as being privileged, as being chosen in some way to have privileged access and have more insight when he looks into his own mind and into the minds of others than anybody else does. So why should he listen to Charlie? He's the writer. I create for a living, you monsters. So Barton seems to think that he is the one who knows what the life of the mind is all about, and Charlie couldn't possibly know. But of course, we know Charlie has a very active life of his mind, and he knows some things about what the life of the mind looks like that Barton probably doesn't know, because all humans know something about their own minds that no one else knows, because that's what makes us human. So when he's screaming, "I will show you the life of the mind," he is offering to show Barton a very specific life of a mind. And it's a refutation of this idea that Barton knows and Charlie doesn't know. Of course Charlie knows what the life of his own mind is like. He lives his own life in his mind. And as he says here, he says he'll help people out when things get all balled up at the head office. And we could say that Charlie is representing some sort of metaphorical idea here, that by chopping off people's heads, he is liberating them from the curse of consciousness. And there are a number of philosophers who have said that, you know, consciousness is a curse, and that we are in fact trapped by the fact that we are self-aware and that we have language and that we can speak different languages and look at the world from different points of view. So when Charlie says he tries to help people out, if we were to take it to a sort of psychotic, logical conclusion, we could say that maybe he really does believe that he's liberating people from this prison of their own thoughts. And he says, I wish someone would do as much for me. And if we were to say Barton has the opportunity to do that by telling Charlie's story, he blows it and he doesn't take advantage of that chance. You think I made your life hell? No, forget it. Come on. Look around yourself, Barton. You're a tourist with a typewriter. Charlie is, from the beginning... Is Charlie a killer at the beginning of the story? We don't know. Probably. You know, Charlie didn't become a killer right when he met Barton. But certainly Charlie was suffering. And as little sympathy as I have for people like Danny Rowling or Jeffrey Dahmer or whoever, there's no doubt that serial killers, certainly a lot of them are abused when they're children. They go through a lot of suffering themselves, and there very often is no one willing to listen to their story or to care about the suffering that they have been through. So a lot of times people feel like, okay, I'm now inflict that suffering on other people, and I've been turned into a monster, whatever it is. Now, that's being very generous. It's a bleeding heart interpretation of the way serial killers operate, but there's no doubt that Charlie wants Barton to listen to his pain and suffering and give a voice to it, and Barton does not take advantage of that opportunity. And as a result, Charlie says he has to pay for it. Now, when Barton says, "I'm sorry," and Charlie says, "Don't be," I don't know. I'm still trying to sort through that line. I don't quite get why Charlie would say, "Don't be sorry." It's possible that he implies that instead of being sorry, you know, don't be a sorry person. Instead, use your opportunity. Use your chance to tell a real story. Give voice to my pain. Or maybe it's just sort of something he's trying to be nice. Or maybe he's just trying to fill the space with words. Circular image there. Something rolling away. I had to stuff cotton in it to staunch the flow of pus. We see Charlie's got the pus there coming out of his ear, dripping again, he said. We see the wallpaper in the back just hanging off there. And here's where he admits that it was a theft. Fire theft and casualty are not things that only happen to other people. And he left the gun above Charlie's or Barton's door there. I don't know if that's supposed to be significant. Barton's still handcuffed. He doesn't have it in the final scene. I don't think he does. I don't think we ever see the handcuffs again. But maybe they're there and we just don't see them. Or maybe he got them removed somehow. Or maybe it doesn't matter. As I said earlier on, I was pretty angry when I first got the DVD because the menu, when you first start it up, shows Charlie running through the hallway yelling, "I'll show you the life of the mind!" Well, that's a pretty big spoiler. If you've never seen the movie before and you pop the DVD in and you see that, you know something about what's going to happen in the movie. I think that was a really bad choice on the part of the people who made the DVD. But that's just my opinion. Again, notice he looks exactly like the dude at the in the play at the beginning of the movie, walking away there with the coat on and the hat, and he's got a package with him. Of course, in the play, he's got a suitcase, but he looks a lot like him. So there's the circular sense in which everything's come full circle. The window there was security. It's possible that it sort of represents, okay, Barton has no security. Nobody can keep him safe, and certainly nobody can protect his family. And Lou's back. So again, this notion that, you know, Lipnick and Lou probably go through this cycle of, you know, get rid of this. Again, we have the facade here. Colonel Lipnick, he's, you know, Henry Morgenstern or whatever. But he had wardrobe whip this up. So again, it's the facade. He wants to think of himself as being a general or colonel or whatever it is. But in reality, of course, he's just some windbag. And then we got the racism of Lipnick here. He wants to dish off on other people, particularly the Japanese. There's a very telling line here when Lipnick says, "If your opinion mattered, I guess I'd resign and let you run the studio, but it doesn't and you won't, and the lunatics are not going to run this particular asylum." That clashes completely, of course, with what he says at the beginning of the movie, where he talks about the writer is king here at Capitol Pictures, and, you know, you don't, but he says, "You don't believe me, look at your paycheck." Well, if that's what it took to become king, then any rich person in the world could be a king, but they're not. It has to do with power, and all throughout it, it's clear that Barton doesn't have any power, and here, that is all laid bare, and Barton realizes just how much the studio cares about what he thinks. Lipnick is, of course, confusing his metaphors when he says, "You make it the carrot that wags the dog." And again, talking about the monolithic audience. The audience wants to see action, adventure, wrestling. And plenty of it. And this is what a lot of modern studio heads say. And, you know, the Coens have said that he doesn't think there are people like Jack Lipnick in the... They don't think there are people like Jack Lipnick in Hollywood these days. But I don't know. When I look at what Hollywood produces, I feel like there are people like Lipnick running the show. And they want to produce things like Blood, Sweat, and Canvas. And they want to put out movies that seem somewhat deep. You know, they got a little bit for the critics, but really, they're just giving the audience what they want. And the same is true about the music industry. They keep producing things that are, you know, dime a dozen rappers that come along, dime a dozen sort of fake, aggressive rock groups that seem like they're so angry, but really they're not saying much in their lyrics. And they want to give the audience what they want. But they won't provide the deeper, more significant artists who are saying important things, the bully pulpit that they really deserve. If there were any justice in the world, the coup would be twice as famous as Lil Wayne, but, you know. And not to say that Lil Wayne doesn't have talent, he does. But Boots from the coup has talent and is saying really important things about the world, whereas Lil Wayne seems to mostly talk about getting high and, you know, all the money he has and stuff. Now, here's a point where I think Barton, if we can take Barton at his word here, can we ever take him at his word? I don't know. But at this moment, it seems like Barton is really trying to be sincere and say, like, this is what I was shooting for. But now we see Lipnick furious, more furious than ever, and making it clear he does not care at all what Barton thinks. And again, this notion that, you know, what's in your head doesn't matter, Fink. You know, you're here to work for us, and we tell you how it works. It's a job like any other. The boss tells you what to do, and you do it, end of discussion. And Barton is amazed by that, because he's led himself to believe, and he's allowed Lipnick to fool him into believing that his job was to create things that are amazing and different. And, of course, it isn't. And so now the ocean wave crashing against that rock has a very different sense to it. We have an exterior shot here now. Finally, a number of critics have indicated that this has a similar feel to the end of Dolce Vita. I think that's the name of it. Dolce Vita, right, 1960s. excuse me. Another similarity, as I wrote on the Wikipedia article, another similarity is that of Barton Fink's beach scene to the final moment in 1960's La Dolce Vita, wherein a young woman's final line of dialogue is obliterated by the noise of the ocean.
The unsettling emptiness of the Hotel Earl has also been compared to the living spaces in Key Largo, 1948, and Sunset Boulevard, 1950. And of course, as I say, there are sources for all of these claims about the connections between these things. On the Wikipedia article, there's a lot of stuff I haven't talked about, like connections to The Shining and a movie called Sullivan's Travels. Roman Polanski's movies were a heavy influence on the Coens, and in fact, he was one of the judges when Barton Fink was up at Cannes, and there's lots of information about there about that on the Wikipedia article. So now he's literally inside the picture here. This is obviously a very important moment because when we talk about how the picture compares to reality, it's obviously not a nice picture. And Barton, throughout the whole story, has been moving into the picture. And now he finds himself inside that moment, and he doesn't know how to deal with it. And obviously the reality of what he's up against in terms of the studio, in terms of his own creativity, in terms of the power of his storytelling to affect the world around him, i.e. he has none, all of that stuff has come crashing down around him, and he realizes he's just another schmuck with a typewriter, right? Other than Underwood. He asks her if she's in picture. She says, don't be silly. We come back to the idea of things just being jokes. It's all a big joke. We might say that the whole movie is a joke on the viewer. Ha ha, whatever. She strikes the same pose. In a way, we can say it sort of looks like a military salute, which would fit in with the Pearl Harbor World War II time period. But maybe that's just me reading into things. However, I did read in an interview one time that the Coen brothers did not plan that. And that thing with the bird was a total accident. They were filming her on the beach, and she made that gesture, and they were ready to wrap it up, and that bird flew in and went, "Aah!" and plummeted into the water, and they said, "Oh my God, that's perfect. Print it." The students, I love this moment when the credits start to roll, is my favorite moment of the whole experience watching it with students, because they always get really mad. And I was like, "This movie is the worst movie I've ever seen. How can anybody like it? What is wrong with you, Mr. P? How are you liking this movie? You're such a moron. I hate it. Blah, blah, blah." And I always tell them, okay, look, we're going to talk about it tomorrow. On the fourth day, I show them my little presentation with all the questions on it. And I tell them, please don't judge it. Carter Burwell, by the way, does a lot of the music for the Coen Brothers movies, and he's an awesome composer. I love this. Roderick James right there, the editor, that's actually the Coen Brothers. They use that. They edit their own movies, and they use that as a pseudonym for when they're doing their editing. And So they always list the Roderick James as their editor, even though that's them doing it, because there's a rule with the something to do with the rules of the Screen Actors Guild or something involving some union in Hollywood. Again, notice the camera moving down here. But the funny thing about that is that in the introduction to the screenplay book for Barton Fink, the introduction is written by Roderick James, and it's obviously the Coen brothers writing this introduction, but it's presented as though it were this fictional editor guy writing the preview, and he says that the plot of Barton Fink is, quote, crushingly tedious. So it's pretty amusing to hear them bad-mouthing their own movie through this fictional character of theirs. So the students get very mad when we watch the movie, and I tell them, look, wait until we have this, you know, fourth day of discussion, and we dig around in all of these themes about suffering and the life of the mind and what's in the box and all this stuff. Sometimes the students get really mad because they want to ask me, you know, what's in the box? And sometimes they end up sounding like Brad Pitt at the end of Seven, you know, what's in the box? And I won't tell them. When we finally finish watching the movie on the third day, we usually have about 10 or 15 minutes left in class, so I say, any questions? And they start yelling, what's in the box? What's going on? What's happening? Ah! And I won't answer their questions directly. I will always either quote a line from the movie, or I will ask them a question. So when they say, you know, what does it mean that Barton is in a moment that's very much like this picture in his hotel room? I always say, well, that's an interesting question. What do you think? And they get really mad about that, and they don't want to try to give an explanation. They're like, you know, you just tell us. But I always tell them, and I will tell you, dear listener, that these theories of mine, they're mostly just theories. Even the critics that, you know, agree with each other on the Wikipedia sources, they're critics. It's their interpretations. And in a way, it's important for all of us to make up our own minds about what the meaning of these things is. And it's not that I have answers because I've seen it a lot and that I've thought a lot about it and I've written about this movie and I've done research. Okay, that gives me some insight. I can tell you what the Coen brothers have said, but there is a sense in which
you still have to make up your own mind about it. And I'm honored that you think that my opinions are worthwhile and certainly worth listening to, and I appreciate that, definitely. But I still would hesitate to say that people should trust me and that they should base their opinion entirely on what I think, and that people should make up their own minds. And certainly, if you have thoughts about any of the stuff in this movie, please do let me know wherever you got this sound file from. I'm available at FBESP, Floating Brain of Eric S. Piotrowski.org, FBESP.org, and you can find my email there and get in touch with me. And thanks for listening, and thank you.